Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hi, this is Pod Save the UK. I'm Coco Khan.
And I'm Nish Kumar. This week, the BBC is under fire from left, right, centre and the US president. We'll dig into just how perilous the situation is for the corporation.
And as one of our least favourite Tories begins posting AI-generated slop to attack his political opponents, I speak to the AI and online safety minister, Kanishka Narayan.
And as COP30 kicks off in Brazil, we ask, can we still rescue the 1.5-degree climate target? We speak to Alex Reid from Global Witness.
But first, this is my crystal ball music.
Do you remember crystal ball music?
Yeah, you have to imagine I'm gazing into a crystal ball. And
yes, but I'm trying to imagine why, because I know what you're going to talk about.
Okay.
But, so that's my confusion. My confusion is everything.
Okay. Because what we're going to discuss is a Westminster bubble story.
Yeah.
So we're going to gaze into the Westminster bubble, which is a crystal ball. Yeah. Yeah, does that work?
I think at this point, me and the listeners are used to your circuitous logic.
Do you know what I was just thinking about? Sorry, this is a... did you ever used to watch shows like Saved by the Bell?
Of course I watched Saved by the Bell.
Okay.
I'm 40 years old.
Yeah. Well, you know, they'd have this thing where they'd have a memory and then it would all go pink around the edges.
Yeah, and it would slightly blur, yeah.
That's the vibe I want you to have. Just imagine sepia tones, it's all wavy around the edges, something
Mr. Belding,
is happening.
Screech, AC Slater...
Something is happening in our imagination, and that is the Labour Party is in a meltdown.
Yeah.
The MPs are in a corner. They're sharpening their knives. They're whispering in hushed tones.
Yeah.
And number 10, they've gone into full bunker mode.
Okay, FBM.
FBM.
As we record on Wednesday morning, all of the papers are leading on the rumour that Keir Starmer's prime ministership is at genuine risk. Why? Well, it seems that a number 10 source sent out a range of briefings to the British press on Tuesday evening, warning that the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, was on manoeuvres to pressure Starmer out with as many as 50 front benchers ready to resign if the incoming budget is poorly received.
So the question is, why now? We don't need to tell you that Starmer is deeply, unbelievably, historically unpopular. So you remember I was saying about how this fantasy of the Labour MPs with their knives out?
Yeah.
Depending on where you stand, for some people...
I remember something that happened 2 minutes ago? Give me some credit. Give me some credit, Coco.
Okay, I just mean, depending on how you feel about Keir Starmer, that could be a dream come true.
How bad do you think my ADHD is? I've not got the disease that the guy from Memento has.
God.
I don't need to take a Polaroid to say Coco Khan has just brought up the MPs sharpening their knives and then or have it tattooed across my torso.
Well, anyway, just for clarity, it's something that I said mere moments ago. I just mean, depending on how you feel about Starmer and what's going on, it could be a complete nightmare or it could be a dream come true. He's very, very unpopular, despite his promises to make tough decisions. The MPs have lost faith. I think the country's kind of lost faith. And people are wondering, has he actually got the ability to deliver on what he said he was going to do? There's a lot of conversation about the incoming backflip on their manifesto pledge of not raising taxes. Look, it's a big deal.
And also, there's another crucial thing happening when they're trying to make the political calculation whether to get rid of Starmer, and that is next May's local elections, which is looking like being an absolute bloodbath for the Labour Party, at least according to the current polling. Now, look, sometimes local elections are seen as a kind of bellwether for a government, and opinion givers of the world have a tendency to view local elections as being like a litmus test, and it's more about what it implies on a national stage. But it actually has real day-to-day consequences for political parties. If the party loses control of Wales and a lot of councils across the country, those councils actually serve as the grassroots for the broader Labour Party. So it's really, really severe. It's not just a symbolic bloody nose for Starmer. It could be an actual operational difficulty for the party on a day-to-day basis. And I think that's part of the thing that is driving some of these MPs into the kind of mode of, you know, essentially regicide.
Yes, absolutely. So the question is, what does Wes Streeting have to say about this? Well, here he is speaking to Amal Rajan on BBC's Radio 4 Today programme.
That briefing is categorically untrue. I think it's extremely unhelpful, not least because it basically says from a number 10 source, the Prime Minister's fighting for his own job. No, he's not. He's fighting to turn around the country.
His interview with the Today programme is actually a lot more, I would say, sober in some ways than his interview with Sky News, where he, when he was asked if he was planning a leadership challenge, he said, whoever's been briefing this has been watching too much Celebrity Traitors. And this is just about the worst attack on a faithful I've seen since Joe Marler was kicked out and banished in the final. So does it suggest that he's taking this hugely seriously? I don't know in this analogy who the Alan Carr is. I don't fully know who the Claudia Winkleman is, but I'm very confused. When he was asked if he would rule out challenging Starmer after the budget or demanding his resignation, he said, yes, and nor did I shoot JFK. I don't know where Lord Lucan is. Had nothing to do with Shergar. And I do think that the US did manage to do the moon landings. I don't think they were fake. So I think Wes Streeting is trying to sort of, you know, pour as much cold water on these rumours as he can possibly muster. But
it must be quite good for him, though, being across all of the press, being spoken about as leader and coming up with these funny little refrains. I'm not convinced that this is just a rumour that Wes Streeting has no designs on it. You could probably gather that from my exclamation. I think there is no smoke without fire.
Listen, we spent the first year and a half of this podcast essentially talking about governmental psychodrama and internal fighting. When there was a change of government last year, people said to me, oh, are you worried you're not going to have anything to talk about now? And I kept saying no, because I actually don't fucking care about this stuff. Like, it's just not of interest to me. The thing that I'm interested in is talking about politics. And when I say politics, I don't mean who runs what party and who's briefing against who. I mean policy that actually has the ability to improve the lives of people living in this country. That is what ultimately I'm interested in. That is what ultimately I think we all need to be interested in. And I think I was honestly, maybe naively, hoping that we would be done with this fucking shit. I was really hoping that we would be done with talking about briefings and who's briefing against who and whose camp is briefing against who and listening to politicians poo-poo talk of a civil war by making, you know, at best tenuous references to current pop culture trends. Part of the reason I think I was hoping we'd moved away from that is Starmer's promise to the country was not particularly specific on policy, but what it was specific on was a promise of reasonable, sober leadership and an end to the chaos of the Conservative Party. That was the whole promise. We are bringing an end to the chaos that the Conservative Party has wrought on the country by continuous infighting. And so this is a bad goddamn look. I feel very frustrated.
I agree with absolutely everything you've said. And I would also just say, just reflecting on our own role as people who discuss politics, I've always been very frustrated when Westminster bubble stories dominate the conversations around politics and not actually the lived experience of British citizens whose standards are in decline and what politicians are not doing to change that. However, for this particular one, I think the question of Keir Starmer potentially not being leader is actually quite important and potentially an opportunity.
Yeah.
People are saying that the Labour Party is dead, but there's no denying that there's been very good people in the Labour Party and the Labour movement as a whole, I would say, has been positive for Britain.
Yeah.
It would be a shame for it to kind of just die in this limp way. Could a new leader revitalise this? Now, we can have a question about whether we really need a Labour Party, perhaps a more broad left coalition of various different things is actually more appropriate. Okay, that's fine. That's a separate question for now. But just in terms of the Labour Party, which I think we would agree would be good if it existed and was effective and lived up to the Labour Party movement and what it claims to be on its card, then I think there's an opportunity to save it here. Anyone that would take over from Starmer would have to be more to the left. Would have to be. It couldn't be more to the right, really. Like, it wouldn't. They'd need to distinguish themselves. They would see also what's happening with Zach Polanski. This could be an opportunity. This could be a moment.
But it's of no use if they're not coming to it with an actual policy platform. Like, there is no point in replacing a kind of walking set of valueless platitudes in a suit with another walking set of valueless platitudes in a suit.
But the AV said somebody, we didn't do that.
What I would say is, if you're planning on replacing Starmer, you need to tell us what you are replacing Starmer with, not who. I don't care who it is at this point, right? I'm not interested in the name. I'm interested in the substance. So if there are people manoeuvring against Starmer, then eventually what we will need to hear is why, from a policy perspective, and not just because he's unpopular, right? Not just because he's polling badly personally, and not just because we're interested in winning the next election. There is still a lot of time between now and the next general election. So if somebody is planning on replacing Keir Starmer, we need to know what they would do differently. And I don't just mean in terms of internally in the Labour Party. I mean what they would do differently for the country.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I would also be open to Keir Starmer returning to the politician he was when he went to the Labour membership and said, this is who I am and my values.
Yeah, right.
I would also be open to that.
So you'd be in favour of Keir Starmer overthrowing himself, effectively, like essentially.
Yeah. I would forgive him. I would be like, look, you went for a phase. We all have our moments. You've returned back to who you are.
You think Keir Starmer is like Tyler Durdening himself?
Maybe.
This is a sort of Labour Party version of Fight Club.
So anyway, from one depressing story onto another, the BBC is under attack. Donald Trump is taking legal action, claiming that the broadcaster defrauded the public over editing of his infamous January 6th speech in a Panorama episode. His legal team have given the broadcaster until Friday to issue a full and fair retraction of the documentary alongside a hint of damages or face being sued for a whopping $1 billion.
It's a head-spinning set of developments that's seen the BBC's Director General, Tim Davey, and Head of News, Deborah Turness, resign. And however you feel about the BBC and whatever its limitations are, it raises big questions about the future of public service broadcasting in the UK and globally. Just Google the words BBC and existential to see how serious this is. And it all comes from a story that broke a week ago in The Telegraph that cited a leaked memo alleging institutional bias by a former independent advisor to the BBC's editorial and standards board, Michael Prescott. And this included the claim that Panorama had edited two sections of Trump's speech on the Capitol Hill riots to make it seem as if he was directly encouraging violence amongst his supporters.
So in this case, it was undoubtedly a failure in the BBC's editorial process. The BBC's chair, Zamir Shah, called the edit an error in judgment and apologised. But this is just one incorrectly edited clip. Why has it caused such hysteria? Well, the scale of the fallout is less about the original mistake and more about the political wrangling around it. According to The Guardian, Robbie Gibb, a senior BBC board member, had been instrumental in appointing Michael Prescott, whose leaked memo started the whole damn thing, and that Gibb had led the charge in applying pressure on the BBC board over its findings.
So Gibb was Theresa May's former communications chief, and he actually helped launch GB News before he was appointed to the BBC's board by Boris Johnson. He's previously been accused of politicising editorial appointments after he blocked a more left-leaning journalist from the board, and more recently, 400 media figures signed an open letter calling for a sacking over what they call his bias when it came to BBC reporting on Gaza.
This has led to accusations that while Gibb and Prescott say they are defending BBC impartiality, their version of impartiality is overtly partisan. And this is part of a coordinated, politically motivated attack on the broadcaster. BBC chairman Zamir Shah has dismissed suggestions that the BBC has fallen foul of a right-wing coup. He said it's fanciful. But for many, the suspicion remains.
And look, all of this has come at the worst possible time. So the BBC's charter renewal is looming in 2027, and it's leaderless at a time where it has to start deciding how it is funded and what its purpose should be. It's also an enormous political headache for the government. Do you back your national broadcaster or your most powerful ally who has an absolute sexually charged love of two things, tariffs and suing media organisations? Yeah. This is part of a kind of broad gaslighting project by the Trump administration, right? The reason that the insurrection happened on January the 6th is because Donald Trump openly disputed the results of a free and fair election with no factual basis. So we're all now participating in this enormous global project of denial of basic facts. Broadcasters will make errors all the time. I'm not saying that they shouldn't be held accountable for them. But this is the entry point for a larger conversation by people that want the BBC gotten rid of. And a lot of progressive people have lost faith in the BBC and lost faith in its ability to accurately reflect events, whether it's in Gaza or whether it's around transgender rights. What I would say is, yes, the BBC is an imperfect organisation, but there are two really key principles here. We desperately, desperately, desperately require a media organisation that is not owned by either big tech or a single multi-billionaire, okay? The BBC is owned by us. If there are problems within that organisation, we have the ability to hold it to account. We do not have that same ability to hold GB News to account. We do not have the same ability to hold the Daily Telegraph to account. We do not have the same ability to hold Rupert Murdoch's media empire to account, okay? If there are problems at the BBC, we can deal with them. We own the BBC. It works for us. And it's a news source that is trusted globally and by the vast majority of people in the United Kingdom, okay? The second thing I would say is, if you're a progressive person, the BBC is a publicly owned utility. And whatever your problems are with it, it seems fundamentally anathema to a progressive mindset that you would think that we don't have to defend a publicly owned asset, especially in the media landscape, the way the media landscape is right now. This is a tipping point for the entire of the BBC. This is an existential crisis. And if people are not willing to defend it now, it will go. Pod Save the UK is brought to you by Shopify.
Picture this. It's midnight and you're lying in bed, or maybe it's mid-afternoon and you're sitting on the sofa. You're scrolling through this new website. You've seen something cool on Instagram. You've clicked through. You're going to buy it, but wait, you need to get your card. You don't know where that is. What? You need your details. It's like remembering your PIN code. We don't do it anymore, guys. So what are you going to do? You're about to abandon the cart, but luckily that's when you see it, that purple shop button. That shop button has all of your payment and shipping information saved. It's saving you time while keeping you warm in your bed or on the sofa. That's Shopify, and there's a reason why so many businesses sell with it, because Shopify makes everything easier, from checkout to creating your own storefront.
Shopify is the commerce platform behind 10% of all e-commerce in the US, from household names like Mattel and Gymshark to brands just getting started.
Shopify gives you that leg up from day dot with hundreds of beautiful ready-to-go templates to express your brand style and forget about the code.
Tackle all those all-important tasks in one place, from inventory to payments to analytics and more.
Spread your brand's word with built-in marketing and email tools to find and keep new customers.
And did I mention that iconic purple Shop Pay button that's used by millions of businesses around the world is why Shopify has the best converting checkout on the planet. Your customers already love it.
If you want to see less carts being abandoned, it's time for you to head over to Shopify.
Sign up for your $1 per month trial and start selling today at shopify.co.uk/podsavetheuk.
Go to shopify.co.uk/podsavetheuk.
shopify.co.uk/podsavetheuk.
Now, it's that time again. COP30 marks a decade since the Paris Agreement was adopted in 2015, when the 1.5 Celsius global heating limit was first agreed. With the world now on the precipice of irreversible global heating, this year's climate summit has been branded the last chance to secure humanity's future. So, no pressure then.
The talks are being held in the gateway to the Amazon in Belém in Brazil. So it's no surprise that deforestation, which counts for about 11% of carbon emissions, is a defining issue. But things are off to a shaky start, with tens of thousands of acres of rainforest felled to make way for a four-lane road to the summit. I actually can't believe that I'm having to say this out loud, but they felled tens of thousands of acres of rainforest to make a road so that they could get to the summit. And many leaders from the world's largest nations, India, Russia, the US and China, are also notably absent.
So here to tell us about the aims of COP30 and whether that 1.5 Celsius target can be rescued is Alex Reed. So she leads the deforestation, nature and finance team at Global Witness, an investigative campaigning organisation that challenges the power of climate wrecking companies. Alex, welcome to Pod Save the UK.
Thank you so much for having me.
Alex, in most of my life outside of this podcast is doing comedy about the news. And when I hear things like Dave cut down a load of trees to build a motorway to get to a climate conference, I feel redundant and frustrated. How does someone in your line of work feel when you hear stuff like that?
Yeah, I mean, you've got to stay optimistic, right? Yeah. Like, this is why we do the work. And we know that it's a long journey to bring that temperature rise down to 1.5C. I think it's absolutely still alive. I mean, it's the first few days of COP. Yeah. If anything, I actually think that road is a bit of a red herring. Yeah. Like, I know there was some strong BBC reporting about it. Mm-hmm. There was then quite a lot of digest from other climate groups saying perhaps maybe you got this wrong. The road was always going to be built before the summit. But I think it does bring to life just like that tension around development and around how we're going to square what we want to see in society with the transition to net zero. I mean, for me, we're still in the very early days of COP, right? There's long negotiations ahead. There's going to be a lot to follow. But I am so happy that it is taking place in Belém. I'm so happy that it's taking place in the Amazon. I went last year. It's a beautiful place. It's like buzzing with culture and diversity and mobilizations and art. And it's one of those summits which isn't taking place in a resort. Like, yeah, I want the negotiators to get out there and sweat it out in the heat and to know what it's like for the rest of the world when temperatures rise. Every year we at Global Witness, we track the number of fossil fuel lobbyists who attend the COP. Yeah. And last year it was absolutely shocking. There were 70% more lobbyists connected to the fossil fuel industry than there were the total number of the delegations from the 10 most climate vulnerable countries. Yeah. So it's just like absolutely crazy that, you know, the COP has been co-opted in this way.
Right. You've hit the nail on the head. That's why whenever I hear about COP, whatever number it might be, I have this feeling of that this is just going to be essentially a big business pursuit, or there'll be some greenwashing exercise. I get the sense from you, though, you feel much more positive about it. Why?
I feel positive about it because if we didn't have COP already, we'd have to invent it. Yeah. Like, the moment that we got rid of it, we'd be like, oh my gosh, we need to bring all these countries back together again, because no single country can crack this alone. I mean, COP stands for Conference of the Parties, and we often like make jokes, you know, that it's fossil fuel lobbyists standing round with their champagne and their canapes, like trying to strike the next oil deal. Like, the past two have been really problematic, held in UAE and then Azerbaijan. We did a big undercover investigation last year that showed that the executive of the Azerbaijan COP was actually up for making oil and gas deals. And so we kind of caught him in a bit of a sting. Right. And we thought that they'd learned quite a lot probably from the UAE presidency, who struck a bunch of oil and gas deals after the COP. So that's one clear thing that really does have to change for us to remain like optimistic and engaged with the process. So we're absolutely chuffed to have pushed through a really key reform at the COP, which is basically that now when you're registering, you need to say who's funding your trip, and you need to say that you're there to lobby and to participate in the spirit of achieving that 1.5C goal. And that's absolutely essential. If not, get out of the COP, please. And actually, in the first week, President Lula in Brazil, he really scored a big goal. It's his legacy initiative. He's just launched the Tropical Forest Forever Facility, which basically is a huge fund, high ambition, that's going to aim to put more money into conservation of tropical forests.
This is a really big and interesting deal, right? So it's snappily named the Tropical Forest Forever Facility, or TFF. And it's kind of the centerpiece of the summit. It's a multi-billion dollar initiative to protect tropical forests. How does it actually work?
Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated one. I think the first thing to say is that it's really exciting that it is an idea to help end deforestation that is coming out of a tropical forest country like Brazil. Like, you know, the previous 29 COPs were majority decided by global north powers. Right, yeah. They set the terms. Ooh, should we give you this money? I don't know, like, on what terms. It's really important that Brazil is hosting this COP and that they've come up with this idea. So that's great. Without getting really wonky about it, because at the end of the day, it is a fund. What Brazil
You're doing
really...
a really good job of being really excited and energised about what is a financial fund.
It is a financial fund, yeah. And I'm not going to make you read the documents. It's the good news. I've read them for you. So basically, Brazil want to grow this thing into $125 billion. Mm-hmm. Basically to serve as like a pension for rainforests is a helpful way to think about it. So they want to get governments, philanthropists, the private sector to pool their money together into one big pot and then invest that in global markets, generate a profit and give most of that profit back to rainforest countries based on the amount of forest that they have standing. If they get it right, what's exciting is that this actually isn't climate aid as we know it. Yeah. It's an investment. So in theory, say if the UK or the US or whoever in the future is to invest, that money isn't going to be deplenishing if the markets play right. And that's obviously something that we might not have confidence in. Mm. But in theory, they'd be making a small return and at least their capital should be safe, a bit like a pension.
But the initial investments that a fund makes, what if they're not eco?
Yeah, this was a big concern for us. So we were absolutely over the moon that they have ruled out investing in oil and gas.
Okay.
And they have ruled out investing in deforesting assets because it's very clear, like, you can't put money into fossil fuels and use that to pay trees. But that is kind of what the financial system is based on at the moment. And that's what makes me nervous about this kind of like privatization and financialization of climate aid. Yeah.
We start from a place where they're ruling out investing in fossil fuels. That's a good thing. That's a good red line. But what are the tensions that remain between those two pots of money?
I mean, what makes the fund exciting and the reason why governments want to buy in is because right now we don't have a persuasive answer to how to keep forests standing. They are being chopped down at a rate of about 18 football pitches a second last year. But the tension, and what makes it less exciting for me, is this lingering feeling niggling at me that the financial sector have found a whole new way to make money from climate chaos.
Right.
So a month before the COP, Global Witness did massive financial analysis looking at 50 companies that had been accused of deforestation. So someone had written about them, they'd put their findings to the company and they weren't persuaded, right, that this company hadn't conducted deforestation, hadn't been linked to land rights abuses often, you know, stealing land from indigenous peoples. There's a real connection here in the deforestation economy. And we found that globally, banks had made 26 billion from deals with just those 50 companies. And obviously the TFFF is extremely important, right? But unless you regulate at the same time to say, and you can't invest in deforesting companies, are we in this weird situation where potentially you've got like government funding, ensuring private funding to kind of play the market and the banks are making profit from both ends? So, you know, no one's got the cash right now to make a big contribution. But there are things that we can do. Mm. We can change our financial system by saying, you can't invest in those companies anymore. And it's pretty simple, to be honest.
But regulating the financial sector has been, it's been the sort of white whale. I think we were sort of hoping that we'd see a Labour government that was more interventionist in that area. But it's something that Rachel Reeves seems reluctant to do because it seems to be sort of at odds with the growth agenda. I mean, bringing it back to the UK, historically, we've sort of played a big role in stopping deforestation. So we brokered a commitment to halt and reverse deforestation by 2030 at COP26. The government has also contributed to the structure that's underpinning the TFFF. But then on the eve of COP30, they announced it will not contribute financially to the fund. Why is that?
Yeah, I mean, this is the low point, I'd say. Like, we were really in the tent and we were really driving the TFFF conversation from the chats that I get to have with civil servants.
Yeah.
I mean, the first thing to say is it is good that Keir Starmer showed up in Brazil. There were questions about that. And I'm glad that he went there. And he was really unequivocal in his speech. He was like, we are all in on climate change. Like, we know why this is important. So that was a great gauntlet to throw down. But the reality is that it is a bit of a kick in the face to Brazil that they didn't contribute to TFFF. And the big elephant in the room is obviously the budget, right? Mm-hmm. At the end of this month.
Yeah.
And how this is going to play with people. We actually did some polling. It was done by More in Common. And there was, you know, 2/3 of the British public want the UK to meet its commitment to end deforestation by 2030. Including reform voters. So, you know, I think that the question is, like, who is trying to break down that consensus about nature? Who is trying to break down that consensus about climate change and why? And, like, who are their polluter paymasters? Mm-hmm, like, why do they want to import this kind of, like, culture war that actually doesn't exist here yet from the US?
Is that what you think is going on with Tyson Farage? Because if we're saying that there's even a support base for climate policies in the reform camp, is it simply just the sums of money that we are aware of that are going into reform from the oil and gas industry?
I mean, we've got to get fossil fuels out of our politics. Like, that's absolutely essential. I mean, just like the COP, we shouldn't have fossil fuel majors making decisions about future policy in the energy system. It just doesn't make any sense. Like, even at the moment, you know, in the lead up to the budget, we've been scrutinizing this deal. A lot of the work that we do is this kind of like deep finance work and then trying to communicate it to the public, which shows that, you know, Shell and Equinor, which is this big Norway oil major, are trying to do this deal that basically would enable them to write off more than $1 billion in tax.
Yeah.
And we're sending letters to Reeves saying, here's your billion. Like, they're trying to get away with basically not paying into the system. So, you know, you ask, like, what should UK government be doing? I mean, one thing is to get fossil fuels out of politics and to speed up that phase out of fossil fuels. Like, that's absolutely essential. But it's not just about the money. Like, we can't afford to be misled to think that there's this binary, that it's affordable housing, better jobs, cheaper food, or net zero and green. Like, that just isn't the case.
That is the way the conversation has been steered, right? Farage is definitely a huge part of that. It's been steered into a binary between net zero and affordability for British people. We should just always make clear whenever we have this conversation, according to an analysis of Reform's donations by the New York Times, in 2024, the party raised £4.75 million, 40% of which came from people who have openly questioned climate change or have investments in fossil fuels or other climate polluting industries. They are not acting in the best interests of this country. They're essentially acting in the best interests of their sponsors.
And as Nigel Farage's output on Cameo will tell us, he will say anything for money. Just before we let you go, Alex, so I just wanted to ask, you know, at the beginning of this, we talked about how this COP was meant to be the last chance. Do you think that target, that 1.5C target, is it possible we can limit it?
We absolutely are able to do this. When we have this like academic conversation about is 1.5C alive, we have to remember what happens with every single fraction of climate change. Like, you've just seen the hurricane, right, in Jamaica. Yeah. Like, look at the devastation. Remember those floods in Pakistan. That's going to grow even more regular if we don't try every single lever that's available to us. I mean, the irony about this whole thing is that actually the technology that we need in terms of renewable energy has never been so available, you know, so affordable, so effective. So actually the solutions that we need are largely on the table. The problem is, and this is like the COP for implementation, the COP of Indigenous peoples, the COP of truth is what they're saying. The reality is that states were supposed to show up with plans that showed how we were going to meet 1.5C. And they haven't. And so this really is about political will. And this is where it kind of comes back to that point about inequality. The people who want you to believe that 1.5C is dead are the polluters. They are the 1% who believe that no matter how much the climate changes, they will just buy their way out of the problem. Like, that's why they're happy with the system. They want it to go on that way. What we need to work out now is if we're going to overshoot that target, what are the consequences going to be? And then how do we come back absolutely as rapidly as possible with like every tool in the belt to stop that?
Alex Reid, thank you so much for joining us on PodSafe the UK.
My pleasure.
After the break, I sit down with the AI and Online Safety Minister, Kanishka Narayan, to discuss the government's new measures to crack down on AI-generated child sexual abuse material. PodSafe the UK is brought to you by Babbel.
Why do most people want to learn a new language? It's not because we all love memorising grammar tables or topping a leaderboard. It's because we want to speak it out in the real world with real people. And Babbel gets you there fast.
Learning a language with Babbel is all about small steps, big wins and progress you can actually track and feel. Their bite-sized lessons fit easily into your daily routine and are also easy to remember.
Just 10 minutes a day is enough to start seeing real results. And that's because Babbel recognises that real-world connections are at the heart of language learning. The courses are designed by over 200 language experts. That's real human beings to teach you relevant words and phrases you'll actually use. So you can start speaking with confidence in as little as 3 weeks.
Babbel lets you practice real-life conversation step by step without the stress. And Babbel is more than just lessons. They even offer a large collection of podcasts where Babbel experts reveal language secrets and offer an inside look at local cultures.
However you learn best, by listening, speaking, reading or writing, Babbel adapts to your style and keeps you motivated with personalized learning plans, real-time feedback and progress tracking.
Make fast, lasting progress with Babbel, the science-backed language learning app that actually works.
Here's a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription at babbel.com/PSUK.
Get 60% off at babbel.com/PSUK. That's spelled BABBEL.com/PSUK. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Hey, it's Sophie and Will from Sky News.
Too many headlines, too little time.
We get it. And that's why we're bringing you Cheat Sheet.
10 minutes every weekday morning.
All the big stories from politics to pop culture, minus the noise.
No doom scrolling, no spin, just the stories that matter from two people who live and breathe the news. Cheat Sheet with Ridge and Frost from Sky News.
Follow Cheat Sheet wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, with the floodgates of AI-generated content wide open, new avenues for harmful material have emerged. So this week, the government is introducing new laws to prevent AI-generated images of child sexual abuse material. Joining us now to discuss how the government intends to crack down on this material is Kanishka Narayan, the Minister for AI and Online Safety. Welcome to PodSafe the UK, Kanishka.
Coco, it's great to be here.
Great. Well, look, you know, always good to see legislation moving fast, particularly because tech moves faster. In the last year, we've seen OpenAI's Sora and Google's Veo emerge into the market. These are AI video generating tools. I mean, you know, I'm sure we've seen the Queen rapping. It's delightful, isn't it? But perhaps unsurprisingly, we've also seen these tools used for very, very malicious and nefarious purposes. So there's been an increase in child sexual abuse material, which according to the Internet Watch Foundation has more than doubled. So just tell me, what are these laws going to do about it?
Yeah, Coco, I think you've absolutely hit it spot on, which is that as we've seen AI usage rise, we have seen some of it being used for abuse. Today, or the laws that we've passed now mean that targeted experts have the power to spot the abuse and to stamp it out before it gets out into the wild. They are now legally able to use appropriate material in a targeted way to spot child abuse in AI models before those AI models are used to carry out abuse.
So it's not that new content has been made illegal. This sort of material has always been illegal. Rather, it's that you're allowing AI platforms to check for it better. Is that right?
We're allowing a set of targeted experts to be able to check for it better. So as you say, the content is already completely illegal, has very robust enforcement against it where it involves child abuse. That is fundamentally the priority for us to stamp out. What the law now does, in light of the changes we've made, is it arms those, the police, a trusted set of experts, to be able to spot it and make sure they're enforcing it even better.
Ah, but not the platforms. Because I think this is the contentious bit, right? So the AI platforms still really have no responsibility around this.
The AI platforms have a legal liability around this. And so if you are a social media platform, if you are an AI chatbot where users share data with each other, if you're an AI chatbot where users draw on search, which uses live website search as well, there is a legal liability on you to make sure children do not see harmful material. And so let me be very clear about this. The platforms have a extreme and clear sense of liability under the legislation already. Where we're going further in light of the new changes is we're arming our police, our trusted experts, to crack down them even bigger.
Just while we're talking about some of the government's work around dangerous material online, I did want to talk to you about the news that the government is tightening up laws around the imagery of strangulation in pornography. The reason I wanted to ask you about this is I did a story on this years ago now, right? And at the time, I was in my late 20s, early 30s, a lot of my friends were dating, and it was just a thing that was coming up on WhatsApp. This guy I met choked me. I didn't ask first. And there's like a variety of responses that just my friends would give at the time. You know, I didn't feel comfortable. I was a bit scary. Oh, it's fine. They like it. Oh, I actually do die like blah, blah, blah. And it just made me think, oh, this is so strange. This has come out of nowhere. And now all of a sudden it's everywhere. Started looking into it. And of course, I teamed up with another reporter who was also looking into how the rough sex defense was being used a lot in terms of defending perpetrators who had ultimately taken the lives of their partners.
And I found myself in these lengthy conversations about whether it was the government's place to do something about this. Now, the government's decided that it is. So I guess my first question is, do you think this is going to be controversial? And my second question is, how can you even enforce it?
Yeah, well, Coco, I think tribute to everyone, including you and others who have shone a light on this over the years. I think where we have now reached is that there is a very clear evidence base. 38% of women say that they have experienced choking during sex. And we're finding that women who experience non-fatal strangulation are 7 times more likely to then experience fatal strangulation. Let me just pause on that, because that is a really critical bit of evidence. What we're finding now is this isn't just a kind of innocent, consensual thing between two adults. We're finding in many cases that this is the precursor to something vastly more sinister down the line. And that is the reason why we're making sure that it is now amongst the most serious offenses when it comes to online content and the extremist forms of pornography depiction as well. And so that is really important. In terms of enforceability, like the Online Safety Act is focused on platforms. We want to make sure that those who are generating profits from sharing this sort of content are the ones who are held liable, and they feel the full force of enforcement as well.
I just do want to stick with you on the strangulation thing, just because it has been lingering in my mind for so many years. And I'm quite surprised to see a government talk about this, to be completely transparent. I feel like it's been one that's been a question that's being swerved for a while. And when I talk to some of my friends again about this issue, we often talk about how these depictions, you know, how much power do they have really? And I always use the same kind of comparison, which is that if you're driving a car and you decide to have sex while you're driving it, because you've driven a car and you've been in a car before, you would know that that's probably not very safe. But most of us haven't experienced strangulation. So if you're just being shown all the time that it doesn't hurt and it's not harmful, then of course you have a strange idea about it. But then we come back to this thing about, is it the government's place to tell people how they can express their desires? Is it the government's place to know about that? Is it the government's place to be enforcing it with age verification, for example? This data will be held. People will know what people get off on. How do you feel about that? Is there not a... What's the phrase I'm looking for? Isn't this not a bit of a poison chalice?
So let me be very clear on the scope of what we're doing. What we're not doing is telling people what to do in their bedrooms, right? This has nothing to do with government showing up at your house and telling you what to do. You should do whatever you want within the realm of the existing law there. That is not anything to do with us. The second thing we're not doing is we're not saying that you shouldn't privately communicate with each other if you're in a consensual relationship in whatever form you want. The specific thing that we're doing is on platforms where users share content with each other in a public way, we are making sure that those bits of content, which exactly as you say, they shape our sense of what is normal, they should shape our sense of what is safe, and ultimately in cases they are viewed by children, we are making sure that on those platforms, on public expressions, that the most extreme forms of violence and pornography are now no longer allowed. And that is a thing that I think I find across the constituency that I represent in Wales, but even indeed across the country. When I say to people, we're stopping young kids from being able to see extreme forms of porn online, people say, yeah, that's exactly right. When I say that we are stopping the most extreme forms of pornography where there is evidence of subsequent escalation to fatality, people say, well, that is exactly right. What this is not about is interfering in people's private lives.
On this show, we looked at how easy is it to beat the age checks. It's really easy, really, really, really easy. And there's a question there, because fundamentally, people will hold the government responsible for the harms they experience online. As much as we know that it's platforms, we will blame the government for not standing up to them. And of course, the government's in a very weird position with the tech giants at the moment. We kind of need to work with them. There's a lot of productivity targets. But at the same time, this thing is happening. Do you feel that this is the right tool for the job?
Look, I think there's been a lot of conversation around age assurance. The finding is very clear. As a consequence of age assurance checks, we are finding that the traffic on some of the most challenging websites has materially reduced. And you know, people say it's very easy to get around on VPNs. We found that actually after an initial spike, there has been a leveling off in the use of VPNs as well. So we will get more data in time, but I'm feeling confident that those measures have been very effective in the starting place that they're in. But look, of course, it's not a sort of once and done thing, right? The online environment is changing radically. People are accessing tons more information all the time. It is quite rightly the government's responsibility. And the thing I would do in my job is to assure you and assure everyone listening in that the children's safety is the top priority for me in this job. And we are doing everything we can to make sure that we're keeping up, not just with technology, but staying ahead of it, which is exactly what the changes that we brought in that I mentioned at the top of the conversation are about.
So you know that phrase, like you have to break an egg to make some omelets. What eggs are acceptable and what eggs aren't, right? So we have a very vocal listenership. They talk to us all the time. Actually, I'm just going to read you a message that we received from Jack, who has concerns for the trans community. So they say the OSA risks closing down access to safe health information and spaces for trans, non-binary and other LGBTQ folks. The definition of potentially harmful material is so vague that huge swathes of well-curated information and well-moderated spaces risk being closed off. Our listener Jason also wrote in to acknowledge similar restrictions. You know, there will be people saying, of course, child safety is the most important thing. I think we would all agree that. But other communities will be caught up in this. Is that acceptable to the Labour Party?
Well, look, I think if there are specific instances people want to bring up, I'm always very keen on engaging deeply on the specifics. But the big picture is very clear. The duties that have come into play so far are focused on just two areas: content that is already illegal and content that harms children's safety. I would struggle to imagine many forms of content, especially potentially harmful bits of content, that fall into that scope. There's a future world in which we are introducing some changes focused on legal but harmful content, not to outlaw it, but to empower users in those cases. And so the thing I'd say to your listeners is, if they think there are bits of content that are helpful for them in particular, that are not illegal, that don't critically threaten children's safety, you know, I'd be very keen on making sure that they are not just permitted under where we're going, but supported, because it's clearly a very important area.
So am I right in thinking you're saying essentially there may be some teething issues, but they will be corrected over time?
Yeah, I think at the moment the scope is very clear. Stuff that is currently deeply illegal or threatens children's safety is the only content that is caught up in the duties implemented. And I would be very surprised if important bits of health information are caught up in that.
Obviously, it's not my job to feel sorry for the Labour Party. That's not my job, of course. But I do think this is quite a difficult position for the Labour Party to be in, because there is this reputation that Keir Starmer has of being two-tier Keir, of being quick to ban, of being anti-free speech, anti-free expressions. And this is being wrapped up into that. I just wanted to ask, you know, how concerned is the party about this reputation? Or is it a case of, well, when everyone sees how much better we've made the internet, then you'll see that this was right?
I think this conversation, unfortunately, in the kind of Westminster bubble, is played out in a very unhelpful way. Because when I speak to parents, they say, we want the government to go further. We want to make sure that our children don't carry extreme porn in their pockets on their phones. That's what we're doing. And other parties, the Reform Party, is opposing that. They want children to go around carrying that kind of extreme content. And so do I want to take that fight on and represent the Labour Party's views? 100% I do, because I think that is exactly what the public deserve and what they expect of us.
Sorry, when you were talking that, I just had this really strange image in my head being like, imagine if at the next hustings, all the parties had to provide their view on what sex should be like. I just had this weird moment being like, will they act it out? I don't know if I need this.
Let me just be very, very clear. I have no position to tell people their views on that question. What we're doing specifically is where content is illegal, where it is deeply harmful for children's safety. That's where we're focused on. We're not in the business of telling people what to do in their private lives.
Let's talk about the international impact. The internet is, of course, a global affair, and it's not just people in the UK that have raised concerns. So a couple of weeks ago, we had the co-founder of Wikipedia, Jimmy Wales, on this show. He was talking about it. Wikipedia has challenged the act, but had its case thrown out, as Ofcom, they haven't targeted the organisation. So it's not really a case for them to make at the moment. I do want to play you a clip, though, because I think that represents his argument best.
This idea of blocking people and not seeing their content anymore applies to social media. Like, if I block you, I'm not going to see your posts anymore. Yeah. Okay, that's simple, right? But we're working together, collaboratively editing. And then the idea that we need to identify volunteers, which could be, for example, for age-gating purposes, that's super dangerous. Like, one of the things that's really important to us is that a lot of people who are editing Wikipedia in places like Russia, Saudi Arabia, places where you can get in real trouble for speaking some fairly simple truths, anonymous editing is quite important.
So look, we don't want to see a world where Wikipedia is forced to exit the UK. I mean, what would you say to these concerns of international organisations?
Well, look, I think the thing I'd say to them is free speech is legally protected under the Online Safety Act. And so the thing I strongly encourage everyone to do is to look at the specifics. There is no interest in this government in stopping people from engaging freely online. In fact, we want to support it. We have put it on a legal footing. We want to make sure that free exchange of information, I use Wikipedia very regularly. I want to make sure that it stays in the UK and is robustly used across the UK. But at the same time, I think it's right for us where there is a very clear course of either harm directly to children or illegality that we look at that. And in the course of Wikipedia's particular case, I think that some of the content they're talking about is future legislation or regulation that might be considered rather than present codes that have been implemented. We're, of course, going to continue to review that and make sure that we're supporting services that are important to the public in Britain.
You back Ofcom a lot then, I'm guessing. You feel that it's quite a big, substantial job, isn't it?
It's a huge job. It's a huge job. Look, the internet is a massive waterfront for any regulator to be engaging with, right? And it took 8 years to get this legislation right and to get it across Parliament. And so, of course, Ofcom has a big job on their hands. And it's not a context where I'm sort of blindingly backing them all the way. I had a very robust conversation with them just yesterday. I want to make sure that they're going further, they're going faster when they need to enforce. And in other areas where they're doing it well, I want to make sure that we're backing our public servants rather than just talking them down at every turn. But it's a balanced conversation. And I feel we're in constant review.
So there's one popular website that has simply refused to comply, and that is 4chan. Sorry, I hate mentioning 4chan. It's not my favourite thing to do. Look, if you know it, it's got a lot of bad stuff on there. Racism, homophobia, transphobia. There's it's basically a checklist of all the things that the Online Safety Act is trying to limit. Ofcom has issued fines, but the website's refused to pay. I mean, what can we do about this?
Well, look, there are rogue criminals all over the country and beyond. And when that happens, we want to make sure that as a government, we have the right law to go after them. We arm the regulator with the enforcement powers to go after them. And that we're doing everything in our power where we're finding people breaking the law and then running away from it. We're going to chase them down and make sure that they pay for it. So that's the case with 4chan. And I'm backing Ofcom all the way to be able to enforce its fines.
That's quite tricky, though, isn't it? Because 4chan will say, well, actually, under the First Amendment, and they're a US company, they operate under their own laws. You know, how can Ofcom enforce the law against the company that, well, A, doesn't care, but is also into other jurisdictions? I think there's also concerns when we're talking about American companies and the administration that is in place in the States at the moment. You know, JD Vance has been calling out the UK, saying that we have a problem with free speech. This seems like a big problem for Labour. Like, are we going to see... I mean, the phrase I'm really going to say, are Labour going to go hard on this? Is this a battle that they're really taking on?
Yeah, I think there are two things I'd say to this, Coco. One, free speech is a deep part of our heritage here, and we're doing everything to support it and enhance it. But the second thing is very clear as well. If you're operating in Britain, you're operating by British law. And if you're breaking that law, we're going to come after you wherever you are.
Now, before we let you go, we just need to get your reaction to this clip. I imagine you've already seen it, but it's from Robert Jenrick. He... essentially has created an AI video of David Lammy. It was followed on from the Deputy Prime Minister subbing in during PMQs. I'm sorry, I have to play it to you, but here it is. Okay, so for listeners to the podcast who aren't seeing this, lucky you, it's an image of David Lammy. He goes up to stand at the speaker's box, and then all of a sudden he pulls on a clown costume, a red nose, a floppy hat, a ruff and everything. I just want to say, I can't prove that that's racist, but it feels really racist to me. There's something about that that feels maybe hinting at minstrels. I feel very uncomfortable with it. But don't worry, I'm not going to ask you to comment on that. What I want to ask you about is political figures generating AI content. We're seeing quite a lot of it, certainly from across over in the States. How ready are we for this? What's going on amongst politicians in terms of what they are doing?
Look, I think the thing I'd say about the particular clip is, to me, it's another sign of people in the Tory party trying to somehow desperately seek attention on the precipice of extinction. And Robert Jenrick, I think, should be apologising for the state of our prisons and the state of our public services that he and others left this country in. But the broader picture question that you ask is really important. One, I think we have a responsibility as politicians to uphold the integrity and quality of the public debate that I think the public demands and expects of us. But two, the thing I'd say to your listeners and to the broader British public is very clear. in the modern world of social media information, it's on all of us that we are able to hold up good quality information, but that when we see the sort of behavior that you've just shown in that clip, that we're able to call people out and say this is not what is in line with British values.
Kanishka, Narayan, thank you so much for joining us on PodSafe the UK.
Thanks, Kiko. Great to be here.
So we've actually had a delivery come to us from Amazon Music. We've been made into Funko Pops.
Oh, no! Okay, first of all, this doll is identical, except they put a beard on yours.
No, the dolls are very different. Look, my one's got much curlier hair. Coco's already pulled the legs off her Funko Pop. He completely pulled the whole thing apart.
This is one for the therapist, I think.
I am given to understand these are not commercially available.
No, they're not. I think it's so that we can remind the listeners that our podcast is available on Thursdays on Amazon or wherever you get your podcasts.
And Funko Pops are available wherever you get your Funko Pops. Don't forget to follow at PodSave the UK on Instagram, TikTok and Twitter and Blue Sky. PodSave the UK is a reduced listening production for Crooked Media.
Thanks to producers James Tyndale and May Robson.
Our theme music is by Vasilis Fotopoulos.
The executive producers are Will Yates and Katie Long, with additional support from Ari Schwartz.
And if you want to send us in toys, do it.